some great speakers and great guests here. So our speakers today are Christine from Yale. Mark is famous in the computational biology world. He began his work at Harvard, where he got his PhD, and then moved for a PhD work at Cambridge, where he worked at Enterprise Trivia. And then from there, he was at Stanford with Michael Levitt. And in 1997, he joined the faculty at Yale in the department of molecular biophysics and biochemistry, and now he's also with the Department of Computer Science. He's received numerous investigator awards from the Navy, IBM Pharma, Donahue Tech Foundation. He's the Howard L. Williams Associate Professor of Applied Medical Informatics. He's published 189 papers. So, very much to have him here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate very much having the opportunity to come and visit you here at Johns Hopkins. I certainly had a wonderful time so far talking to I'm going to talk to you today about molecular networks and using them to understand protein function on a genome scale. And I thought at the beginning I'd just give you a little perspective of the overall problem in kind of the field. My lab does research in the world of omics, studying sort of populations of molecules. And of course, the granddaddy of this is the genome, the population of genes and nucleotides and so forth. But there's, from far as I know, people have sort of looked at a lot of other kind of molecular types of populations, the proteome, the transcriptome, and so forth. And sort of in relation to this, you might look at the frequencies that these terms are kind of occur on the web. And so here's how often they occur in the Google hits they got. And this was done actually a couple of years ago, but I think it's fairly representative. And here's how often these terms occur in PubMed. And actually, over here, I've actually graphed the occurrence of these terms over time. This is actually for a few years ago. But you can see how there's a great increase in the frequency of these terms, reflecting the popularity of this kind of omic type of science, and how these other types of populations, such as the proteome and the transcriptome and the metabolome and so forth, have been increasing in some sense more rapidly even than the genome. So my lab does research in sort of three areas of omics. First, we're very interested in analysis of the genome, and we look at, in particular, pseudogenes in the human genome, protein fossils. And then the second thing we're interested in is, after the genes have been characterized, trying to get at their function. Here we're very interested in using molecular networks for that, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And then finally, once essentially characterized functions of molecules, one can also look at their structures in more of a structural genomics context. And we're also interested in some problems in this. And so this is an outline for what I'm going to talk about today. And so don't be intimidated by all the text on the slide. I'm going to be showing it to you over and over again throughout the talk. And what I'm going to do, first of all, is tell you why we might want to use networks to try to understand protein function. And then I'm going to talk about where networks come from, how they're generated computationally through evidence integration. And then the last part of my talk, I'm going to focus on what we can learn from looking at networks. And I'm going to look at kind of two types of analyses. One type focusing on the analysis of static network structures, and then another type looking at the analysis of network dynamics. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about why we might want to use protein networks to characterize protein function. So first of all, here's the problem as I see it, at the scale of the problem. This is a representation for the first human chromosome sequence, chromosome 22, which was done by Dunham et al. At the Sanger Center a few years ago. And when this chromosome was sequenced, there was roughly a little bit more than 500 genes found on it, and about half of them could be biochemically characterized in a traditional sense. And you see we had a few hundred things we wanted to characterize what they did biochemically. And now, of course, with the sequencing of the entire human genome, we have tens of thousands, if not more, of uncharacterized proteins that we want to think about what they do functionally. And the question really before us is, does our traditional way of thinking about molecular function scale to this size? And what is our traditional way of thinking about molecular function? To some degree, I think it's encapsulated by this page here, which is taken from the UniProt database. As I see it, our traditional way we think about biomolecular functions, we give molecules names, okay? So for instance, here's a molecule, elongation factor 2. It has a descriptive name that we talk about. It also has an identifier in this database. And then we have lots of papers that people work on, where they publish facts about this molecule. And then a curator or someone thinks about all these papers and tries to describe the function of the molecule in some sort of summary sentence, a fairly compact representation, maybe a paragraph or so, that describes in words what this thing does. But that's traditionally what people have done. But there's some obvious issues with this type of thing. First of all, there's just fundamental complexities in thinking about molecular function. I mean, first of all, a lot of times really to grapple with a function, you really need many proteins. And you can't think of the protein as really being associated with a function in a one-to-one way. Often, a lot of times, proteins have many functions themselves. They just carry out completely orthogonal and different things. And then there's, of course, the issue, there's many types of function in biology. There's molecular function, cellular role, phenotypic manifestation. And then we also have to deal with the issue that because in the biological sciences, people haven't had to deal with this type of scale so much in the past, they tended to develop lots of terms which are very interesting and sometimes whimsical, but really don't scale to the tens of thousands. And so I just have some examples of some of these funny terms here. One that I like a lot is starry night. This is the name of a gene in the fly. It was named about 10 years ago by this Professor Adler. And now how did this thing get this name, starry night? Well, they found that when this gene was mutated in the fly, it would change the hairs of the fly to occupy this type of arrangement. And this person, Adler, who I'd never met, was a very erudite person, and he realized that, oh, this pattern of fly hairs looks a lot like this famous picture by Vincent van Gogh called Starry Night. That's the shown up here. And you can see this is a very intelligent person, very erudite connection. But then you ask yourself, is this really going to scale, this type of logic, the tens of thousands of things? No. But in the biological science literature, we have tons of examples of this type of thing all the time. And so, therefore, there's some people who started to think more and more about more systematic ways of organizing molecules. And one sort of obvious way of organizing things is to put them into networks. And, there's a sort of one type of network is just simply a hierarchy or a DAG, and, people have used these for classification systems such as the GO system. But there's more generalized networks that, say, David Eisenberg has popularized, and lots of other people, including Gary Bader, have popularized, where the functions of proteins are, in some sense, circumscribed by all the things they interact with or associate with. And I just want to give you a little bit more motivation on why networks are really useful for understanding biology. And in this picture, I try to give you the idea that networks occupy a kind of sweet spot, kind of midway place in our understanding between where we are and where we want to go. So right now, with the advent of the sequencing of complete genomes, we have a complete genetic parts list. Okay, and this is a 1D parts list, a list of parts. And, of course, where we want to go in the far future is we want a detailed 3D structural mechanistic idea of how the cell works. A real chemical idea of how it works. But we're not there now. And realistically, we're not going to be there in any time soon. And so kind of where we want to focus is kind of almost like this sort of 2D or midway position where we have kind of a wiring diagram where we have the molecules and we have how they're related, but we don't really know the detailed 3D mechanism of what's going on. And that's kind of encapsulated by networks. And I think that's kind of why they're a powerful representation for where we are now. The other very powerful thing about networks is they're used in lots of contexts outside of biology. So, for instance, here's a book written by a network theorist named Barabasi, where he's talked about how networks are used in many contexts, for instance, of course, in the internet. There's neural networks, there's networks for disease spread, there's social networks. And the nice thing here is that since these networks are used in many fields, one had a situation where the language that's used kind of transcends the field. And so if we can describe biological molecules in terms of networks, people in other disciplines can actually understand what we're doing and not be completely confounded by our terminology, as is kind of the case now. And a final reason I think networks are very powerful in biology is because they're a fairly simplified representation, they provide a uniform way of integrating a lot of diverse information. So for instance, you can have many different types of biological data or evidence, and you can map it onto the network framework and then integrate it in a very straightforward way. So for instance, I kind of show that here, where I show four proteins from the TCA cycle in an organism, and I show how they're connected by many different types of networks. They're obviously in a metabolic pathway, they're part of a transcriptional regulatory network, they have physical protein interactions, they have co-expression relationships, and so forth, and we can map all of this into this network framework. And so that sort of brings me to the sort of first thing I really want to talk about is, well, now that we can integrate lots of information in the framework of networks, how do we put that all together to really generate more robust networks and make predictions? And this idea of evidence integration, of course, is it's a very appealing idea, and sometimes everyone says, well, we should integrate data. Obviously, we're going to get more power from integrating data. But the question really is how to do this quantitatively. You know, how do we quantitatively weight all the data sources? How do we really see the exact improvement that we get from integration relative to looking at things separately? And so that's what I'm going to try to talk a little bit about today. And I have a particular approach for data integration, a sort of Bayesian approach that I'm going to be describing today, try to give you some of the intuition for it, and then to describe some particular results. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out, of course, is we get lots of molecular networks not only from computation, but also from many of these high-throughput experiments, such as the two-hybrid experiment or the TAP-TAG experiment, or more recently the CHIP-CHIP experiment. And one of the things I've been very lucky for in my scientific career is I've got to collaborate with lots of the people developing these high-throughput methodologies, such as Mark Vidal or Mike Snyder. And that's given, I think, some of the work informed it a little bit in terms of the realities of the data. So now I want to start off by giving a little bit of intuition about how we might put together evidence in a kind of statistical approach. And then I'm going to actually show you the results. These are not real results, but I'm just going to give you some intuition. So here, this little picture over here kind of represents a sort of idealized association network where you have proteins represented by little blue spheres and you have connections between them representing some form of association relevant to a particular feature. For instance, you could have a co-expression relationship between things, or there could be a yeast-to-hybrid relationship between two things, whatever. There are many different relationships you could have between things. Co-expression relations, that's a good question. I probably just went a little quick there. Co-expression, people have found with a lot of gene expression experiments that genes that are co-expressed, that tend to go on and go off synchronously, say, throughout the cell cycle or in a variety of other biological processes, tend to be related. And you can look at their gene expression profile, and you can measure the degree of co-expression. And you can threshold this similarity, say, in terms of a correlation or something like that, at various levels and find related groups of genes. And so that would be a co-expression relationship. But the important thing for the intuition here is that there's many different relationships between genes you could find in relation to different features. And one often has the idea of some sort of gold standard of knowledge, where we know just from very detailed knowledge that a subset of the things that we can find relationships about We know their relationship. You know, we know these things interact. We know these things don't interact. And through comparing the kind of association networks over here with the gold standard, one can derive kind of very statistically rigorously kind of quality scores. And in particular, one can compute in a Bayesian framework something called the likelihood ratio for a particular feature, which is basically the fraction of these gold standard positives that have a particular feature in relation to the fraction of the gold standard negatives that have the same feature. Okay. And there's a nice kind of statistical way that you can derive this, but it's a very kind of intuitive type of number. And one can use this as kind of a weighted sense, it's almost like for a weighted vote, as I'll show you in a second. And here's just a kind of quick illustration of how you might use this type of thing. So here's four of the gold standard positives. You can see they overlap with four of the green features. Here's the six gold standard negatives, and you can see they overlap with three. And then from that, you can calculate a number two, and you can do the same for the yellow. And, you know, in the Bayesian framework, you can find that you can multiply these things together, assuming various independence assumptions. And if you take the logs, essentially you add them up. And so essentially these log likelihoods become kind of like weighted votes for each of the features. And so essentially what I'm describing is kind of a weighted vote type of integration approach. Now, notice that some of the features here we have lots of evidence for. For instance, we have both the yellow and the green things supporting our feature. And notice that some things have lots of evidence for them, but they don't occur in our gold standard. And here, we can now kind of extrapolate. We can use the likelihood ratios that we've derived in relation to the gold standard to make a prediction for, say, this particular edge, which we don't know anything about. And then the second concept I want to give you a little intuition for is something called a rock curve. And the idea here is we can threshold kind of a prediction of one of these likelihood ratios at a whole variety of different levels, okay? And when we do that, we're going to get a whole number of things that are going to overlap with our known truths and known our known things that are false. And we can plot that in the framework of a particular type of curve that shows, for a particular threshold, how many of the known true things do we cover versus what our error rate is. And this is called a rock plot. So I've started to give you a little bit of intuition, I think, on how these Bayesian combining methods work. Now I want to show you how they work on some real data, on a little simple problem, and then I'm going to move on to showing them how they work on a genome scale. So the simple problem I'm going to focus on initially is just looking at how we do data integration on one very large protein, RNA polymerase. So this is a protein that has 12, or sorry, this protein is composed of 12 subunits. It's a very important protein. And recently, the crystal structure of this was solved by, I think it's Roger Kronberg, who's the son of Arthur Kronberg. He solved it. You can see exactly what's going on, what proteins are in contact and so forth. And one of the things we were able to do, actually, in collaboration with Al Edwards and Bart Cook in Toronto, is we could kind of make a gold standard from this crystal structure where we could take all the subunits and we could figure out which ones we knew were in contact and which ones are not in contact. Okay? And then what we can do is we can compare this to all the sources of evidence for the things to interact that were known before the crystal structure was determined. Okay? And so, for instance, we went through the literature and we found all the pull-down experiments that had been done on these things, and we looked at which one said these two subunits interacted or that these two subunits didn't interact. And we, you know, found data from, say, cross-linking experiments or data from little bits of high throughput sets. We tried to put all this together, and you get this type of picture here. And you can see that some of the experiments didn't have anything to say about particular interactions. Okay? And then, of course, we can take our gold standard and our sources of evidence, and we can ask, well, which of them agree and don't agree with the gold standard, just like I showed you in this simple example. And you can see, what I think is very interesting here is a tremendous amount of disagreement, right? These are experiments that people had done previous to the structure, and lots of them said there would be interactions, say, between subunit 1 and subunit 10, and there were no interactions actually observed. And then the question you could ask is, retrospectively, if I didn't know the crystal structure, could I combine all of these experiments together to get a kind of better answer than any of the individual experiments? And so you might imagine you could take the union of all the experiments, and so that's kind of shown here. Or you could somehow maybe take the intersection, or you could take some sort of vote of all the experiments. And then the next level, of course, which I showed you earlier, is you could do this Bayesian approach. You could take a kind of weighted vote of all the experiments. And I think that you can kind of see, just by looking at the amount of red in this figure, which is the disagreement with the gold standard relative to green, the Bayesian approach actually does a little bit better than any of the simple-minded approaches. Okay, so now I've given you some intuition, and I've kind of shown you how this actually works on a particular problem. Now I'm going to show you how we do evidence integration on the genome scale. And I tried to give you a little intuition when we started, because I think that the concepts are exactly the same. Of course, now we have lots more numbers, and there's going to be complicated tangles of lines, but the same principles we're going to be using. So now, again, we're going to start out, we have gold standards, and we have sources of evidence that we're going to integrate to try to form this big network, and so that's listed in this little figure here. So our gold standards are going to be known protein complexes, okay? And we're going to have two types of integration. On one hand, we're going to integrate all the high-throughput sources of evidence. For instance, all the yeast 2 hybrid data sets, all the pull-down data sets. We're going to try to integrate them. And you can see these have tens of thousands of known protein pair interactions. And the integration we do there, we're going to call the PI, for probabilistic interactome experimental. Okay? And then we're also going to try to integrate lots of sources of evidence that don't ostensibly have to do with protein interactions, such as gene expression evidence, evidence related to biological function, evidence related to coessentiality. And the integration that we do here, we're going to call the PIP, for probabilistic interactome predictive. And when we do this, you know, we use this Bayesian networks approach. There's a variety of technical issues when we do this, but the long and short is, again, we integrate all of the interaction sources into the PI, all the non-interaction sources of the PIP, and then we actually integrate them again into something called the PIT. And here's what the prediction kind of looks like matched up against our gold standard. You know, the green lines are our predicted lengths, and you can kind of see how they overlap very well. Now it's sort of more of, how should one say, you sort of get a sense of it rather than see exactly what's going on as you did in the simpler examples. And here's a particular example. We predict all these lengths down here. These were known in the high-throughput experimental data. These were known in the gold standard positives. And you can sort of see how the predicted length sort of join these two things together, just to give you a sense of things. Now, a little more quantitatively, one of the things we can do is, remember, we have our likelihood ratio, which is kind of like our weighted vote for how strong each edge is. So we can ask, well, how strong are our edges? And we can ask, how strong an edge can we get from one feature, or from integrating two features, or from all the integration? And then how many edges get above a particular threshold? And what this picture shows you is, it says, if we take a very high threshold of around 600, we can predict 10,000 new edges, okay? But that if we take any of the individual features, okay, by themselves, none of them can actually get above this likelihood ratio threshold. So you can kind of see how only through integrating a variety of sources of information can you get a high enough weighted vote to, say, get above this particular threshold. Okay? Now, one of the things we were very lucky with is, while we were doing this, we had the opportunity to interact with some very, very skilled proteomicists in Toronto, Jack Greenblatt and Andrew Emily, who were doing a lot of interaction experiments. And so we made a whole variety of predictions, and then they tried to verify these predictions. And this just shows you a de novo prediction that was actually verified with an experiment. So we predicted that all of these proteins, say in yeast, interacted. And previously, we had known that all the guys that are connected by the little blue lines interacted, and also all the guys that were connected by the gray lines interacted. And you can see that the little blue lines created something called the replication complex, which was known in yeast. And the gray lines created something called the RFA complex. But we predicted that actually the RFA complex docks on to the replication complex. Okay? And this is a new prediction. And they were actually able to verify this in a blind way, a number of these interactions. And so this is a nice type of verification for a particular case. But it's not a really large-scale verification of these predictions, right, because we're making tens of thousands of predictions. So the next type of verification we tried to do is we tried to take the interactions that we could find to very high confidence, okay, and we tried to compare them against the high-throughput experimental data set. So we applied the same kind of integration procedure that I showed you to the high-throughput data, and we create this thing called the PI, where you have each of the data sets, and you merge them, and then the merged set has a variety of likelihood ratios. And then you can actually construct this kind of rock-like plot that describes how good your coverage is of the gold standard versus your error rate for both things, okay? And so here's this kind of rock-like plot. It's not exactly a rock plot for a variety of technical reasons, but basically you have some measure of error here, some measure of coverage here, and here's our de novo predictions, and here's the experimental data, and actually you can kind of see that for a particular error rate, actually this is an inverted type of thing, we actually do de novo predictions actually does a little bit better than the high-throughput experiment. Okay, now the next question you might ask is, well, geez, I've showed you how wonderful it is to integrate evidence, and I showed you how we can get more bang for the buck through putting lots of things together. Maybe we should just keep on doing that and integrating more things. And so that was our reaction to this. And so we tried to find more features. And so we actually went and we made this tremendous long list of different features, things like synthetic lethality, threading scores, the phylogenetic profile that David Eisenberg popularized, the gene neighborhood, interlogs. We tried to add all these features together to make an even stronger prediction. And I'm not going to tell you in any detail about these features, but I'm going to tell you about how the integration worked, and I'm going to tell you about, in particular, one feature that we could find which was very, very powerful. And the one feature that was very powerful was the interlog feature. And this feature was originally popularized by Mark Vidal in Boston. And the idea behind this feature is, imagine you have a situation where you're trying to predict if two proteins in yeast interact, say, A prime and B prime. And you don't know if they interact, but you know that they do interact in another organism, such as, you know that the orthologs of these proteins interact in another organism. So you can kind of transfer the annotation. And you might imagine if you want to do this quantitatively, you would transfer the annotation as a kind of function of the joint sequence similarity of the two interacting proteins, A and B. And so you can do this, of course, quantitatively, where you have this weighted vote likelihood ratio. And this is your sequence similarity. And you can find that you can get very good weighted votes for likelihood ratios if the sequence similarity between the pairs of proteins is actually very high. And so we could get a very nice feature from this interlog feature. And we developed another feature called regulogs, which is the analogous feature for regulatory interactions. Now, one thing we found, though, was that despite the power of these features, integrating many features beyond that original core set actually didn't give us that much improvement. So here's the original four features I showed you, and here's a rock plot. And here's now seven features, and you see we do a little bit better. The rock plot is a little bit higher, but it's not that much better. And then you might ask, well, why is that? Well, you know, it's a variety of technical things. You might say, maybe the features are very correlated. Maybe all these new features are basically just copies of the previous features. And there's a variety of statistical techniques, I'm not going to describe in any detail, that deal with this feature correlation in detail. One is one technique that's very powerful is called boosting. And so one idea is if we, I'm not going to describe this, but we can try to boost our Bayesian learner, and maybe it would do better. And actually, it didn't do better, okay? And here's just kind of a control that shows if you had correlated data, and you boost it, you would do a lot better. So this kind of shows that in a kind of sideways way that there were no real appreciable, meaningful feature correlation in the data that we're compiling. We're just kind of reaching a limit to what we could do with data integration. And so the sort of overall message is I showed you how we can do data integration and how it is powerful, and I also showed you to some degree the limits of this technique. Now, in the next part of the talk, I want to talk about what we can learn from networks, okay? And so first, I'm going to talk about analyzing static networks, okay? And I'm going to talk about analyzing in terms of global statistics and local motifs, and then we're going to move on to dynamic networks. So we developed a tool for analyzing networks. We call our tool TopNet, and that's because the student who developed this, his name is Taiwan Yu, he very much liked Tom Cruise. And so when he saw these movies, he came to the United States, and then he named his PhD work after the movie. And other people have developed lots of tools for looking at networks, too. The Cytoscape tool, for instance, is a very nice tool that they've developed. And what do these types of tools calculate in relationships? I'm just going to give you some sense of what people tend to calculate, and then I'm going to kind of give you a little vignette about what we find about biology. So one of the things people like to calculate is they like to calculate overall growth topological measures of the network. And so one of the things people look at is the degree of a node. For instance, how many neighbors a particular node has. This one has 5. They look through the path length of the network, you know, how many edges you have to hop over. And so this is, say, a path length of 2 between these, the two blue nodes. Then a slightly more complicated thing they look at is the clustering coefficient, which talks about how connected are the nearest neighbors of a particular node. So, for instance, you can actually understand this kind of by kind of example. If you look at this node, and you see it has 4 nearest neighbors, and these neighbors could have up to 6 interconnections between them, but we only observe 1 interconnection in this particular figure, and so the clustering coefficient here is 1/6. So it measures how connected the nearest neighbors of this particular node. And so these are a variety of things people tend to calculate, and these are not things we've developed. In particular, a lot of the graph theorists, such as this person Barabasi, have developed a lot of these statistics. Now, one of the powerful things about scale-free network, I'm sorry, one of the powerful things about the growth of topological statistics is that they have a lot of interesting patterns. And in particular, one of the patterns that they show is something called a power law pattern or a scale-free pattern that I'm going to explain. So if you take a network, you can graph the frequency that you observe a particular degree, like how many nodes are connected to 10 things, how many nodes are connected to 1 thing. And when you do this type of graph, you often find in many, many networks that if you graph it on a log-log plot and so forth, it will have a nice straight line like this and a particular functional form like this where you have degree raised to a particular exponent. And the neat thing about this is it shows you that the network has hubs, okay? There's a few things, okay, that have many connections and lots of things that only have a few. And that's shown here in this picture here, where you can see these colored nodes, right? These are hubs that have lots of connections. But the key idea is there's only a few things that have them, okay? And it turns out that lots of networks have this power law or scale-free property, the internet, the power grid, and also the protein interaction networks. And the nice thing about this is that this graph highlights particular proteins or parts of the network that are very important. They're the hubs. So there's this idea that, well, maybe the hubs are more important proteins in the network. And so what I'm going to show you here is a population where we try to relate protein essentiality with the hubbiness. And this is an idea that other people, in particular Garabasi and Doug Laufenberger, had before, and I'm just going to kind of show you the type of results. you can calculate how the average degree of, say, the essential proteins in yeast versus the non-essential proteins. So there's about 1,000 essential proteins and about 5,000 non-essential proteins in yeast. And it turns out, you can kind of see, the essential proteins have more connections, or more hubby, than the non-essential proteins. Okay. Then one thing we thought of is, well, gee, there's 5,000 non-essential proteins. Maybe there's some way we can break these up in terms of their importance. And so we, through integrating a variety of functional genomics experiments, I'm not going to describe exactly how this is done, we developed something called marginal essentiality, which is kind of like the, it's almost like a condition-specific importance of a particular gene. But the neat thing here is that you can kind of see that this quantity scales with hubbiness. And so you can see as you become a more important protein, you get more other proteins to interact with. And that was one thing we found. And this is, why is this important? Well, obviously people who are interested in developing drugs and chemicals that are going to target specific proteins, maybe kill an organism or whatnot, they, you know, it's useful for them to know which are the hubby proteins and which are more important and so forth. And, so this is kind of nice because this is a way that you can use interactions as a proxy for the importance of a protein. Now, I've previously been focusing on the interaction network, and now I'm going to look at the regulatory network a little bit too. And so I'm going to be kind of segueing into that. And just to give you an overview of this different type of network, this is a network that connects transcription factors to targets. And in yeast, there's about 150 transcription factors mapped in this network that have about 7,000 regulatory interactions. And this type of data comes from chip-chip experiments that, say, Rick Young at MIT or Mike Snyder at Yale have worked on. Now, when you look at the regulatory network, this is a directed network. It goes from transcription factor to target. And so the statistics you calculate are a little different. You can look not only at the degree, but you can look at what's called the in-degree or the out-degree. So, for instance, how many targets are regulated by a transcription factor, or how many things regulate a given target, or how many things regulate a given protein. So, for instance, this thing is regulated by three things, and this guy regulates five things. Now, when you look at the hubs in the regulatory network and you relate them to essentiality, you find the same thing that you found in the interaction network. Regulatory hubs, transcription factors that regulate lots of targets, tend to be more essential than non-hubs. Okay, that's kind of reasonable. But one thing we found, which is very interesting, is when you look at the flip of this, you look at the target hub, the things that are regulated by lots of transcription factors, you find that they actually tend to be less essential. And this is a little counterintuitive. And you might say, well, why is this? And the reason, if you think about it for a while, you can kind of understand it. If you have a gene that's truly essential, it doesn't need to be regulated. It's always on, right? Whereas a gene that's highly regulated, there's many transcription factors controlling it, it might only be on at a particular moment during the yeast life cycle, right? So it can't be essential because it's not needed for most of the life of the yeast. It only occurs in a particular condition, okay? And that's the sort of rationalization for this, in some sense, counterintuitive result. So the next thing people calculate for networks is they look at network motifs, local motifs. And this was something introduced by Alon and his colleagues in Israel. And motifs are, as opposed to taking looking at the whole big network, we're now going to zoom in and just look at, like, the occurrence of little modules. And so one module might be, for instance, a transcription factor regulating two targets, or some sort of a feedback loop, you know, or a feed-forward loop. There's a variety of these different structures, okay? And we can look at the occurrence of the motifs in the network. And here's just a little vignette of looking at the occurrence of these motifs, okay? So one idea that you might have is, well, you know, as I look through the different motifs, if I have more transcription factors regulating a given target, it's probably more likely that that target, the two targets, have a similar expression relationship, okay? And so what we did here was we found the occurrence of lots of these motifs where transcription factors, say, regulate two targets, or there's two transcription factors regulating two targets, or three transcription factors regulating two targets. And then we looked at how likely the two targets were to be co-expressed or have an expression relationship relative to some statistical expectation. And what you can see is sort of obvious. the more co-regulation you have for a pair of genes, the more likely a relative statistical expectation you're going to be co-regulated. Okay, so now I've kind of introduced maybe some of the things we can calculate from looking at large networks, but I focus on static networks. Now I'm going to introduce this idea of network dynamics into the process. Okay, so here again is our regulatory network in yeast, okay? But it's very complicated. You can see there's lots of connections. And we also know that yeast is a very dynamic organism. You know, it does different things at different times. And so we have this idea that we integrated the gene expression data, which kind of tells about which gene goes on at different times in yeast. With this network, we could get a sense of how the network was changing. And so in particular, we integrated five classic gene expression studies: the cell cycle experiment, the sporulation experiment, the doxic shift experiment, the DNA damage experiment, and the stress response experiment. These are classic gene expression experiments done in yeast, done by Pat Brown, David Botstein, Ron Davis, and that basically most of these are done at Stanford. All of them are done at Stanford. And so we group these things into kind of two big groups we call multi-stage and binary. Multi-stage experiments like cell cycle and sporulation involve the yeast kind of going through an intricate sequence of steps, you know, measured by many time points, whereas binary is more of a response to a condition. So this is just an a priori grouping that I have right now, but you'll see how it's important in a second. So then we developed an algorithm to backtrack through our network and find the parts of the network that were on at a given time. It's a very simple-minded algorithm. In caricature, what we do is we find the genes that are differentially expressed, we track back and find the transcription factors that regulate them, and then we track back and find the things that regulate those until termination. And then we find an active subnetwork. And what's impressive is how these active subnetworks look. So here's the entire network for yeast, right, the static network. Here's the network that's active in cell cycle. Here's the network that's active in sporulation. Here's the network that's active in doxic shift, that's active in DNA damage, that's active in stress response. And I think you can see, if I just flip to these, they're actually very different, right? And so you can make this qualitative observation, but now, of course, we want to think about it quantitatively and a little bit more rigorously. And so how do we do that? Well, we're just going to apply the TopNet type of approach that I showed you earlier, where we calculate the standard graph theoretic statistics, we look at the motifs, and so on and so forth. Okay? So that's what I'm going to do now to compare the different conditions. Okay? Now, first of all, before I do this, we should probably think a little bit about what we might expect. Do we have any a priori expectation for how the statistics are going to look on the, you know, what do you expect? Do you expect the statistics are going to be the same for all the networks? Do you think they're going to be different? Well, how would you form an expectation? I'm not going to go into detail, but there's sort of two approaches. One approach, you could do some sort of random simulations of networks of a given size, right? And then see if they differ in their network statistics. Or you could just read the literature and see what all the people have to say about what they expect to happen. And the long and short of it is, I think the expectation usually is that all the networks are going to have fairly similar properties. That's the thing people have always observed. Things tend to be power law. They tend to have similar properties. That's what your expectation is. What do you actually observe? A little different than that. So here's a picture where I show some of these topological statistics, the out-degree, the in-degree, the path length, clustering coefficient, and I show them for the five conditions, okay? And you can kind of see that, for instance, they're a little different for these multi-stage conditions versus the binary ones. Okay, now let's think about that. The out-degree, right, which measures the number of targets regulated by a transcription factor, is lower for the cell cycle and sporulation relative to the binary conditions. That sort of makes sense. You might have one transcription factor just turning on lots of targets in, say, the binary condition. Whereas the in-degree, the degree to which transcription factors are regulated by lots of other things, is much higher for the cell cycle and sporulation. The path length for the regulatory network is higher in cell cycle and sporulation versus the response conditions. You have to more complicated regulation. And the clustering coefficient, the degree to which all the things are connected together, again, is much higher for the cell cycle and sporulation. We do the same thing for looking at our motifs, okay? And kind of quickly, what we find is the very simple motif of a factor regulating Z just one factor regulating a bunch of targets is much more common than the response binary, the binary conditions, the toxic shift, the DNA damage type of thing. Whereas the complicated loop structures, like the feed-forward loop, where you have all these factors regulating another factor and there's making a very complicated loop, is much more common in the cell cycle or sporulation. And so what's the overall picture that you get from looking at the statistics? It's actually very understandable. So here are the five conditions, and we broke them into the multi-stage and the binary. And here's a little schematic that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on in these graphs, okay? And here's a little summary of the basic idea. Well, the basic idea is this. The hubs are more pronounced in the binary conditions. Well, that makes sense. You have more of one factor activating lots of targets, okay? The path lengths are shorter in the binary conditions because you have more of a factor getting its signal out to targets. Whereas in these, in the multi-stage conditions, you have more of a situation of a very complicated walk through a line of interregulation. Likewise, the clustering coefficient and the degree of transcription factor interregulation is much higher in the multi-stage conditions than the binary ones. And finally, and kind of almost as a consequence of this, we see more complicated motifs, such as the feed-forward loops and the feedback loops in the multi-stage conditions relative to the binary ones. Okay, so now I've kind of told you about how we get some network dynamics and how we can calculate a variety of standard statistics on the dynamic subnetworks. Now I'm going to talk a little more about some more novel things that we've calculated. So remember we talked about the idea of hubs in the network, right? Well, we can find hubs in our regulatory network, and we can find hubs that are active at different points. And you might ask yourself, do the hubs stay the same in all the conditions in yeast, or are there some hubs that are active at one point and are not active at another point? Okay. And again, you might have some expectations for this. And, you know, you can look in the literature. Before we worked on this, I think people focused on, well, this hub is always important. It's the hub of the yeast, you know, and so forth. They didn't talk so much about transient hubs. And likewise, you might get the same conclusion from some sort of random simulation. So what do you actually observe? And here's what you observe. Here's a picture that shows your five conditions. And here's a variety of yeast genes. And now what I do is I color them according to their degree, their hubbiness, right? And you can kind of see right away that there's some genes that appear to be hubs just in a particular condition, right? And then there's some that are hubs in all the conditions. So the things that are hubs in all conditions we call permanent hubs, and the things that are hubs in just a particular condition we call transient hubs. Now, you can look at the biology of these things, and it sort of makes sense. There's lots of major cell cycle players as transient hubs, like SWI4 and MEP1, that you see associated with the cell cycle. These are players associated with sporulation, stress response. But what's really interesting is lots of the hubs, the transient hubs that we find, actually don't have any known function. Right? So all the genes here in red, these genes, no one knew what they did. But we've said this gene is a hub, but that only occurs in cell cycle. Or this gene is a hub that only occurs in sporulation. We don't know what it does, but somehow I think this idea now we've kind of circumscribed the function of this gene in a very interesting way, right? We see it's a hub, it's a major player in this particular process, but we don't have a classical biochemical function. So this is sort of getting at the function of these genes. And also this gets at this idea of condition-specific vulnerability of the network. Like obviously, if we knock out one of these transient hubs, like for instance these things here, they might not kill the yeast, but of course the yeast probably would be more sensitive to DNA damage, condition-specific lethality. Now, you can see in relation to these transient hubs this idea that, well, maybe a transcription factor has lots of interactions in one condition, and then it changes its interactions in another one because it's a transient hub, okay? And so we try to quantify this by creating something we call the interchange index. And basically what this is it looks at the degree to which the interactions at one time change over to another thing. So we find some transcription factors that change over a lot. They kind of rewire completely the their connection, and other things that don't change over. And here's a sort of distribution of this number. So one question you might ask is, how unique are the transcription factors to particular conditions? Can you see one transcription factor that's associated with a particular condition that turns it on? Right? And it turns out that's not the case. Most of the transcription factors are used in all the conditions, and that's shown by these Venn diagrams here that look at the overlap between the transcription factors. And you can see the overlap is actually much higher than the non-overlap. And the implication, of course, is that the transcription factors are used in all the different conditions, and they're just kind of rewired. And then you might say, well, how do we get specificity? How do we turn on a particular condition, right? Because it's not one factor that's turning on one condition. How do we do that? And of course we do that through combinatorial usage. If we look at the usage of combination, right, the overlap there, you can see, is very small. Very big overlap for individual factors, very small overlap for combinations. So finally, the last thing I'm going to just tell you about is we then moved on and we said it worked out pretty well finding these active subnetworks, say, between different conditions. Maybe we can break up one time process and look at the active subnetworks that are active in it. And so we took the cell cycle, okay, which is a long process, and that's known to break up into many phases, and we looked at the active subnetworks in it. And that's what I'm going to show you here. So here are lots of transcription factors. And now I look at which ones are hubs and are active in particular parts of the cell cycle. And the cell cycle is broken up into things like the G1 phase, the S phase, the G2 phase, and so forth. And you can see there's different hubs in different parts of the cell cycle. But what's really interesting is when we look at these, what we call phase-specific hubs, we can look, actually, at what exactly they regulate. Now we're talking about a small number of things, right? And so it's very interesting. It turns out that the hubs in, say, the early G1 phase tend to regulate the hubs in the G2 phase, right? Whereas the late G1 ones, you see, tend to have some regulation of things in S, and the hubs in S regulate the things in M. And you can see they kind of drive the hubs in one phase tend to regulate the hubs in another phase and kind of serially drive the cell through its cell cycle. Now, the other thing we found is there's some things that are hubs in all phases, and we call these ubiquitous hubs, or like the permanent hubs that we talked about before. And when you look at what they regulate, you can see they kind of sit on top of all the other things, and kind of, it's almost like they're like the puppet master, right, in the show. And they're always kind of regulating everything else. Okay, so now I'm going to summarize what I talked to you about today. Well, I tried to talk to you today about using molecular networks to understand and predict gene function. And so first of all, I talked a little about why we want to use networks. You know, I gave you some notions of how they're a universal language, they're powerful platforms for data integration, and so on and so forth. And then I talked a little bit about where do we get networks from, computationally, and how we can use networks to integrate lots of evidence. And I tried to give you some intuition about how Bayesian integration works, one particular, but very powerful process. And then I tried to apply it to a simple example, the DNA polymerase example, and then I applied it to the entire yeast interaction. And I found, predicted 10,000 interactions, and I tried to show you how we could verify these in a variety of fashions, both experimentally and in a more statistical fashion. And then I looked at the limits of data integration as we added in more features. We could find some individual features, like the interlog feature, which is very powerful, but we started with the limits of the data integration. Then in the second part of the talk, I talked about what we could get from the networks. Okay, and so here we did a little analysis of the static network structure using the kind of PopNet tool that we developed. And we looked at the global statistics of the networks and how the hubs related to essentiality most of the time, except for the interesting case of the regulatory network for the target hubs. And then we looked a little at the motifs. And then in the final part of the talk, we looked at network dynamics. And here we painted the gene expression information onto the networks. We looked at which networks were active at which times of the cell cycle, and we could find very different global statistics and motifs for the different active subnetworks. In particular, we found that the networks that were associated with the responsive conditions tended to be more of like the transcription factor directly reaching the target and not having much interregulation, as we saw in the multi-stage conditions. And we were also able to identify this thing, these transient hubs and network or wiring, and see how certain hubs were important at just particular times. And I just want to point out in closing that all of this network analysis, it can be very practical, in a very practical, engineering-oriented type of thing, in terms of selecting targets for designing drugs, for doing structure determination, for doing experiments. And so we're part of something called the Northeast Structural Genomics Consortium, and what we're trying to do here is we're trying to select targets in the consortium that are based on looking at a big network of proteins. And so we obviously want to target proteins at critical positions in the network, or we might want to target a protein that we know interacts with another protein and then use the structure to rationalize the interaction, or to solve if we solve a complex, right, between two proteins in the network, it kind of verifies the interaction. And then we can use it as a further gold standard for network prediction. So now I want to acknowledge all the people that have worked on this. And of course, I'm going to do this in the framework of a network, as you might imagine. And so one of the nice things that our PubMed tool does is it also does literature networks from PubMed. And so this is actually a co-publication network that shows all the people that I've published with, and also my closest collaborator, Mike Snyder, who they've published with. And so all the people that have published with us both are shown in green, and the people that are unique to me are blue, and unique to Mike are yellow. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to zoom in on the part of this network that's associated with this in this talk today, and now you can start to see people's names on this, and there's still a lot of people because it's a very collaborative endeavor, and then I'm going to highlight particular people, okay, that have actually done a lot of the work. So who are the main people that have done the work that I've described today? Well, Ron Jansen was a grad student in my lab who's went on to do a postdoc with Chris Sander. He really did develop this Bayesian integration approach and using it for protein-protein interaction prediction. Okay. Haiwan Yu is a grad. We just finished his PhD in my lab. He's a grad student. I was going on to do a postdoc. He developed the TopNet approach and the static network structure analysis. And Nick Lustum, who was a postdoc in my lab and then moved on to a group leader position in Cambridge University, he did the network dynamics, looking at the sort of relating with the gene expression data. Now these three people, of course, are in a bigger network or matrix of interactions with lots of other people that need to be acknowledged. And who are these people? Well, first of all, we've benefited a lot from a lot of collaborations with experimental people, in particular Mike Snyder on the chip stuff, Mark Vidal on the Interlogs, Guy Montignon, the structural biologist for the BioNet, Al Edwards, another structural biologist for the RNA polymerase, who worked with Bart Kuss. And in particular, also with Jack Greenblatt, Andrew Emily, and Evan Krogan, who verify a lot of our predictions. And the network dynamics was also carried out with Sarah Teichman and Madame Babu in Vancouver and Cambridge University. And then the other individuals shown in green in this figure are different people who worked in my lab and worked on these network things with Ron, Nick, and Haiwan. So we had Ning Lan, we had Zhang Chen, who's here now as a faculty at Johns Hopkins. We have Doug Greenbaum, a graduate student, Yuval Kluger, who's moved on to a faculty position at NYU, Brandon Shaw, John Caro, Alberto Pacnero, Jason Liu, and Valerie Trifonov. And I think, and also, we have Sean Douglas, who created this publication graph tool that you're looking at right now. Very important to get all the acknowledgments in. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and I appreciate being here.
A great talk. We're a little short of time, but maybe one or two quick questions.
You talk about the complex networks and simple networks for workflow mechanisms. Are there analogies
Yes, actually, I would say there are. And actually, the way I would think about it, the best analogies really are in social networks. Because, of course, course, people have incredible amount of intuition for social networks. So you can immediately understand lots of very complicated network concepts, you know, like your nearest neighbor interaction, betweenness, and so forth. You can understand these in social context and then map them all into molecular context so they become less understandable. So that's a very powerful aspect of networks because they give us a way of thinking about things much more intuitively because you can map them onto those type of situations. Well, you can certainly calculate, the concept of hubs and network topologies as valuable for the human interaction as the yeast interaction. In particular, in some sense, it's more useful because the networks are actually much more complicated. But the issue that you're getting at is a very interesting issue. The issue of how it relates to essentiality is interesting because what the feature, of course, you were pointing out that we have a tremendous amount of gene duplication as we move into complicated organisms. And and we have so little appearingly essential genes in these higher organisms, and how they fit into the network is actually going to be very interesting. I don't have an answer. But what I actually think will happen is that this concept of marginal essentiality, or so these weaker concepts than gene essentiality, but these weaker phenotypic concepts will actually be more useful for things like that, just for that exact reason that you're pointing out. That's a good point.
Is there any
No, that's a very good question. So I didn't describe the details of the statistics and the calculations, but anytime you have a graph that's got two different numbers on it, the obvious question is, are those two numbers meaningfully different in some context? And so you have to develop some statistical model to understand their difference. And so what we actually did was we developed a part of our whole thing, actually our approach is called SANDI for Statistical Analysis Network Dynamics. We did this for each of the calculations. There's a whole random network simulation that you get a kind of like standard deviation for each of those quantities. And then you can measure relative to that standard deviation some measure of significance of how significantly different they are. And so that's, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I didn't go into that at all, but it's obviously a good question or an important issue.
In the interest of time, I've got it here. Thank you again, Mike.